Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to Project Zion podcast. This is your host, Robin Linkhart, with another episode of What's Brewing, where we focus on mission and share stories of how God's presence is coming alive in transforming ways and sometimes surprising us. Today, our guest is Keith McMillan. Keith serves as a president of 70 in Community of Christ, and he is currently assigned to Arizona Mission Center as a Latter-day Seeker minister walking with people who are exploring Community of Christ. Welcome, Keith. We're really glad to have you with us today.
Hi, Robin. Thanks.
So, Keith, I'd like to spend some time hearing about you. So where did you grow up? What was it like to grow up in the church? How did your life as an ordained minister begin? All those kinds of details that we are dying to know.
Well, I'm really hoping somebody's not driving across Kansas listening to this podcast. They will probably fall asleep. But I've had a wonderful life. I was born in San Antonio, Texas, the youngest of six kids. My mom and dad were wonderful church members. My dad was pastor for, I think, 30-something years, bivocational pastor. He worked for the U.S. Air Force there in San Antonio. And my mother was a third generation or fourth generation Community of Christ or RLDS. Her last name is Booth. Our listeners might recognize that name. My uncle Paul Booth was an apostle and a really dear man to me. And so I grew up in a wonderful congregation in San Antonio. When I was a kid, probably six or seven, we built a brand new congregation, our family, and probably 10 other core families in San Antonio. And it became the Delcrest Community of Christ. And I was so fortunate to be a member of that congregation growing up. They didn't just endure me. And if anybody that's listening to this knows me, that I would have been a challenge for all those people in that lovely congregation. But they absolutely loved me. And so a typical Sunday would be we would go to church. Sometimes when my dad would preach, we'd fall asleep, but because we'd heard all the sermons. But then in between, we would get handed off to church members. It was kind of a wonderful tradition. And so some Sundays afternoons, I would spend time with different church members. We'd go to their house. I'd go to their house. We'd have lunch, and then we'd sit around and do the things that we do, talking and playing games. And then they'd take me back to church at 6 o'clock that evening and kind of drop me back off with my family. But some of the wonderful people of that congregation, one of them was a doctor. So he would make rounds after church and I would go with him on rounds. And I really learned so much about pastoral ministry, especially in the hospital around people's bedsides, watching Dr. Millenizer check on them, you know, just kind of do the medicine part, but also he did the wonderful connection part with people. And I have learned all those wonderful tips of spending hours and hours with Dr. Millenizer walking around the hospital and just had a passion for loving people through that congregation. So that would be a typical Sunday. Of course, they all taught me Sunday school and poured into me and my brothers and my sister for a number of years. And I can look back now at my life and say the foundations of who I am now have come because so many people were so selfless and loving and taught me so much about how to be a good person and how to find that relationship with God. There was a period right after high school where I kind of fell into the wrong crowd. You were asking me about being an ordained minister. Life had gotten a little difficult during that time for me and my parents. My dad was a strong disciplinarian as a military man, and that didn't always sit well with me. And there was a time right after high school where I decided I could just run away, and I had a full-time job, and I could just live in my car. And for a couple months, I lived in the back of a green station wagon. I had my clothes all folded in the back, and I would get to work early at the headquarters of a large restaurant company there in San Antonio, and I would shower before everybody else got there, and then I'd work, and then I'd go live in my car again. And then one of my friends' families invited me to come in and live with them. So for probably 6 months, I was living with them. I had no contact with them. In fact, it made me happy to not have contact with them. I was kind of really in a rebellious stage. And at one point, I remember getting a call at my friend's house, and my friend's mom came in and said, "Keith, your dad's on the phone." And I was like, "Ann, the only stipulation I said for me letting you host me and stay here with you is that you don't tell my parents where I am." She said, "Well, I think you need to talk to your dad." So I went and I got my attitude on, and my dad said, "Son, your mother's had a heart attack and she's having surgery tomorrow, and I really think you ought to be there." And I said, "Well, Dad, I'm pretty busy. If I can find the time to break away from work, I will." I went to work the next day, and my boss had heard that my mom had had a heart attack, and she said, "Well, you need to get up to the hospital." And I said, "You know, Darlene, I'll be fine. Mom's going to be all right." And she said, "Well, if you don't go, I'll fire you." And I had worked there for about 4 years at this point. And I said, "You can't fire me for not going to see my mother in the hospital." She said, "I'll fire you for some reason. So just get up there." And that's kind of the kick in the pants I needed to go up there. My brothers had all flown in and my sister was there. And I remember walking into that hospital, and she was in intensive care, and she'd already had surgery. I kind of missed that. But I just had this real tough guy, you know, "I'm just here to say hi. I'm really busy." And I waved at everybody, didn't even greet my family. And it hurts me now to recount this, but it's kind of who I was. And so I remember when I walked in and my mother, my sweet little mama, was on a ventilator, and it sort of melted everything away in that one hospital room. I could visualize everything I was doing wrong and everything that had been done for me. And it really melted me at that point. And in a moment, I was able to see what maybe I was going to lose. And it broke me down. And a good part of the story is I moved back in with my parents. We became really good friends. And within the span of a year, in fact, April 15th, 1985, I remember this like it was yesterday, I was called to the office of priest, and my dad was my pastor, but we mended all those fences that I had kind of broke down, and I headed off to the University of Texas there, and was there for a couple of years as a priest, and then felt a strong calling to go to Graceland, and I went to Graceland and was a priest up at Graceland, and that really changed my life as well. So I have so much love and respect for congregations who raise little troublemaking kids. You know, I kind of giggle now when I look back at some of the things I used to do. When my mother would clear her throat like this, we would all turn around because we knew someone was in trouble. Most of the time it was me. But those are the little things that you kind of remember. And I was so blessed to be raised in this church. It has a wonderful theology and a wonderful way of treating people. So that kind of began my journey, and I went on to Graceland, graduated in 1987 from Graceland, and moved to the Kansas City area. Both of my parents have passed away now, but I still have little vestiges of them that run through me. My mother would have been an incredible 70 for the church. She just loved everybody she came in contact with, whether it was the guy at the grocery store putting vegetables out, she knew them by name. The cooks at restaurants, she would go back and thank them for the meal. Sometimes she would embarrass us because she was so sweet and loving. But people just loved her. And we had people that came to her funeral that had to tell us who they were. And they were just what we would call average Joes that mom didn't consider average. She never, ever thought the phrase "a very important person" was a good phrase, because she's like, everybody is important and it doesn't matter who you are. God loves you and there's no reason why I can't too. And so she was a wonderful influence in my life. And the reason I think now that I'm so committed to being a 70, because my mother was so loving to so many people. So that answer there was kind of long-winded.
No, that was great. That was great. So you were ordained a priest in Texas, and you were a priest when you went up to Graceland in Lamoni, Iowa. So tell us about your various roles of ministry in the church since then, and maybe a little bit about how the people you served along the way have engaged in mission in different places and different ways.
Yeah, so when I graduated from Graceland, I went to work for a large printing company in Kansas City, and I was there actually for 15 years. But it was also one of those times, you know, where like a college kid gets out of college and like, do I really want to be fully engaged in a congregation in Kansas, in Independence, or, you know, do I kind of want to try it on my own? I was back maybe in prodigal son mode. But there was this wonderful cadre of people at a congregation in Independence called Village Heights. Some of our listeners might recognize the names, the Graffios, the Wileys from Michigan, Barb and Jerry Wiley, and Hazel and Charlie Brown there. And they're just amazing people. And the three ladies, Judy Graffio and Barb Wiley and Hazel Brown, all conspired to, I guess, love me into to being a minister there at the Community of Christ there in Independence. So I hope they're not listening to this podcast, because I call them the witches of Village Heights because they at one point stirred their little pot and they were like, who's going to be our next youth minister? And my face popped up and they were all like, hey, that's great, Keith, come meet with us. So I met with them on a Sunday, and I was kind of a casual attendee at church. And I met with them all on a Sunday, and they said, hey, we really want you to think about being the youth minister here for our congregation. And so I spent some time thinking about it. And they, of course, would invite me to dinner, and they were playing me the whole time. And I didn't see how I was being played by these three wonderful ladies, but they saw something in me that I don't even think I saw. And in fact, I know I didn't see this in me, that I could do something like that. So when I finally conceded and I said, yes, okay, I'll do it. You know, it's sort of like I do every role that I work for the church. I kind of go in it reluctantly going, yes, I'll do it. And then when I get engaged in it, it's wonderful. But those three ladies were standing in the social hall with me, and I said, okay, I'll be the youth minister. How many kids do we have? And they said, well, we don't have any kids. And I thought they were kidding at first. And they said, we just have a couple of casual attendees, but that's why we want you to be youth pastor. And I remember thinking, well, how can I screw this up? How can I screw up being a youth minister with zero kids, right? So, but I started doing it, and it was really wonderful and really powerful in my life to be engaged. And it is hard work. It means going to football games, soccer games, plays. And I did it, no pun intended, religiously, because I fell in love with the youth ministry aspect of our church that helps the very thing that the people at Delcrest did with me, I was doing in this congregation, and I loved it. I mean, hours and hours of plays. Sometimes I got to meet police officers in the community, because some of our kids would get in a little bit of trouble and they would see me out and they're like, hey, you're that youth pastor guy. And over the next, I'd say, 4, 5, 6 years, we built that youth program up to be a really vibrant one. It still continues today. As a result of that, done a lot of weddings and things, and still connected with a lot of the youth that grew up in that congregation, and also got involved in the youth ministries for Central Mission, doing camps, and just thoroughly enjoyed that. And through that process, was called to be an elder. Everett Graffio ordained me an elder, and he said when he laid his hands on my head that he knew I had a call to 70. And he didn't tell me that, of course, until I was called to 70. And Everett also gave me what we call in Community of Christ, a continuing life blessing that is about 10 pages long, that is a powerful witness to me of how connected God is to me and wanting to engage with me more and more as much as I'm willing. And I would say that is a foundational moment, that prayer of blessing by an evangelist, that I look back at very frequently, 2 or 3 times a week, and read it. And it has steered me in a direction, and also it's not a predictor, but I can see things that were said in that because of my faithfulness and God's faithfulness have come to pass. And so it's been an incredible journey with that congregation. And Robin, if you want me to continue on this, maybe there's one more thing I'd say about that congregation and my ministry, if that's all right.
Yes.
Because congregations are, of course, pivotal focal points for people to get connected with, so that we build each other up. We fall in love with each other in wonderful ways through God's love and grace. But I was still working in sales for the printing company and doing very well at that. I really enjoyed the sales aspect and was making good money and could work my own hours and just really enjoyed it. And that's also part of loving people like I have because of my mom and dad's influence. But there was the director of human ministries for the Community of Christ was a member of that congregation as well. And he was constantly, I'd say, lovingly nagging me to work for the church. And I had always told him, his name's Bill Barnhart. He's a wonderful guy. But I'm like, Barney, I am never going to work for the church. That is not my calling. I'm a very good volunteer. I love what I'm doing. But I don't think the church can pay me what I need to be paid. And so for, I would say a good 2 years, Barney just constantly, hey, is it time for you to come visit me in my office? And I was like, oh, I'll come visit you, but it had nothing to do with the job. Thank you. And I was preaching one Sunday, and it was a wonderful experience. I can remember even to this day what I was preaching about. And, you know, sometimes when you preach as you and I do, Robin, you don't remember sermons. But I remember that sermon very well. And at one point, with the strong influence of, I would say, the Spirit, looked out, and Barney and I, our eyes met, and after the sermon, he came up to me, and he goes, you're going to be in my office tomorrow, aren't you? And I said, yes, and I was still reluctant. I was like, more like, yes, I'll be there, you know, just kind of recognizing God going, inviting me, please do this. And I remember going, I'll be there, doggone it, I'll be there. You know, I wasn't real excited about it, but I met the next morning, and I was offered a position as the sort of what we would call an invitational minister now for Central Mission, and they did that for a year. But that began, and that's been 12 years now that started that journey, and I've done a lot of different things for the church. But I can remember the very first starting point working there, and it was all part of an outreach that I had helped start with Village Heights. Called Hawthorne Place, that still continues today, that has reached thousands of young people in an impoverished neighborhood right there by that congregation, that has brought so many blessings and so many powerful ways. In fact, can I share one story out of that?
Yes, please do.
We began this outreach over 10 years ago there, and I haven't been involved with it for the last few, but I, you know, kind of got the ball rolling. And I kind of used the leverage that, hey, I'm the youth minister, and I, you know, here. And if you want me to continue doing youth ministry, we need to get involved in this neighborhood over here. And, you know, it's kind of a, what do you call that? Blackmail, I guess, religious blackmail. It works sometimes. And, you know, and I would always remind that congregation, hey, these are not my kids. So, you know, if you want me to keep doing this, we need to do this. So we began this outreach, and there was this one little girl in the very beginning of this outreach called Hawthorne Place. And they were mostly, it was a subsidized housing unit across from our congregation. And there was this one, the very first time we were there, you had a bunch of mostly older, retired people that are meeting with a bunch of really wild young people that were somewhere from 6 to 12 years old. And I was so proud to have had that first get together. We had worked so hard, John White and I, building that brand new outreach. And they finally invited us in to do this. And the very first night, we had the program, Jam, Jesus and Me, that we worked. We had about 100 kids, and it's right after school on Tuesday nights, and they were wild running the gym. And I was the muscle. So I was constantly, you know, running them down and saying, hey, we need to do this and do that. But there was this one point at the end where we had a little megaphone and we said, okay, this is the end of our program tonight. So what we want to always end on is saying prayers, you know, to God and just asking God to be with us the rest of the week and continue to help us recognize God's presence in our life. And this little girl named Sakile, a beautiful little girl, probably 6 or 7, she always wore the same pink blouse to church, what they call church. And I'm not sure if that was her Tuesday blouse or if that was her only blouse. It was a little tear in the corner. And she said, well, I'd like to. And so she raised her hand and I brought the microphone over to her and I said, okay. And so she said, what's pray? And I'll be honest, it threw me off. I wasn't expecting her to ask me what prayer is, what's pray. And I said, well, Sakila, that's where you just kind of talk to God and you share what's on your heart, what you love, what your concerns are. And she goes, okay, I could do that. And her prayer, and forgive me if I get a little bit emotional about that, but I can see that in my mind's eye so clearly. Her prayer was, dear God, please keep my daddy safe in prison. She didn't cry. It was so matter of fact that I guess it was kind of disarming in a way. And I looked up at Everett Graffio and we made eye contact. And if I had any doubts about what we were called to do in that neighborhood, they were all washed away at that point. Now, I want to fast forward 15 years later. I am at Spectacular with Everett Graffio, Sports Spectacular, the gathering of youth from around the world to come to Graceland. And Everett was one of the originators of that. So we were at Sports Spectacular. This would have been 2 summers ago, I guess it was. And this, we were walking through the MSC, the Memorial Student Center. And this beautiful little girl, not little anymore, she was 19. This beautiful girl came running up to Everett and I, and she's like, hey, guys. And I thought Everett must have known her, and Everett thought I must have known her. And then after hugging on us and just saying it's so wonderful to see us, she said, you don't recognize me, do you? And I was like, no, I don't. And Everett said, no, I don't. She goes, my name's Sakile. And then we both just stood there with our mouth open. She had grown up into this beautiful young lady. She had her mother and her had joined Community of Christ out of that very original Hawthorne outreach. And they had moved out, found a home, and had continued to be members of the Community of Christ. And this is the best part. She said, I am coming to Graceland in the fall, and I'm going to be a nursing student. I mean, you just don't get to see the fruits sometimes of what you're pouring into people, right? And this, and Everett and I on the way home were just like, can you believe that? You know, we knew that that outreach was making a difference in people's lives and our own lives. Firstly, the way God works is amazing. It's not just that we're making a difference in people's lives we're called to. They change us indelibly too. And we just were on cloud 9 going, look at how one simple little program that we know had affected hundreds of kids' lives over the years, but look at the one young lady that maybe wouldn't have had a chance had we not begun that outreach and had we not listened to God's gentle persuasion to come get involved in people's lives in this neighborhood. And so I don't even remember how long ago you asked that question, Robin. But I just, you know, kind of had to share that. I hope you're all right with that.
That's a beautiful story. Thank you so much. I even got teary-eyed about that. And I know what you're saying. Sometimes you don't know the impact of the ministry you're sharing, the importance of having relationship with people. And when you get to see that in such a powerful way, it just, wow. There's nothing like it.
And, you know, that was also that very beginning as a working church then led me to go on. It also gave me a really good foundation on how you build new outreach and development, because they're all different. They're all contextual, and how you try to help people in their lives and get them engaged in a fellowship that can love on them. But from that, I worked, only did that for a year, and then I moved to the East Coast. Lynn Young was an apostle in Community Christ and asked me if I would move up to the Mid-Atlantic and move up there and be a mission center president. And I loved that as well because the East Coast, you know, is dealing with this wave of secularism that we kind of see in the church moving from Western Europe and moving across east to west across the United States. And so helping congregations find their voice and their place in their communities was really important at that time as a mission center president. I'll tell you a pivotal story, Robin, if you got time for that.
Yeah, so let's back up for just a minute because something really important happened before you moved out east, and that was you were called to serve in the office of 70.
Yes, I was. I was called. I actually was called to be a 70 right after I began to do the youth ministry position for still volunteer. I was a 70 and for a number of years. I knew I was called to be a 70 before the call was actually presented to me because I just, you know, with sense of humility, I just felt the calling before the process had even maybe taken place. And I had the fortune, I was fortunate enough to have a lot of friends that helped me build the Hawthorne Place outreach that were 70s. And we spent a lot of time, hours and hours and hours, walking through the neighborhoods, meeting people. And I got to model a ministry from some really wise an incredible 70 in Community of Christ. One of the very first people to volunteer to walk the neighborhoods with me at Hawthorne Place was Linda Booth's dad. He was probably 90 years old, and he and I would walk that neighborhood together and just enjoyed it so much. And I remember thinking, man, if somebody that's 90 has this passion to do this, I can certainly do it as a brand new 70. So yeah, I was called to be a 70, and it was a glove that fit the hand because that was my passion. And I still think of my mother today. I'm proud to be a 70 because I can see the impact that invitational ministry has on people's lives. I don't want to say it has nothing to do with me because I'm a strong believer that we co-create with God, that God presents us with a vision maybe or all the experiences that combine, and then we have to step out in faith and find the people, and that's how we co-create. I used to say all the time, you know, it wasn't me, it was God. And one really wise, happened to be Ever Graffio again, but one really wise man said, hey, quit saying that because God works through you and you work together. And I'm like, yeah, we do, don't we? And you know, I say that with humility. We do with God, but we work. God works with us too, and so God's got faith in us. So, is that what you wanted?
Yes. So you were ordained to 70 in Independence, Missouri area, and then you went to work out on the East Coast as a mission center president, and then you went across the sea, and you were going to tell us a story.
Yeah. So when I first moved to the East Coast, I have this old rescue dog. Her name is Ellie. Somebody beat her up real bad. She jumped in my car and I couldn't get her out of my car. She would go from one door to the next. She had found me and needed help. She's probably only a couple weeks from dying. And I took her to a vet and they were going to put her down. I'm like, don't put her down. And as I'm saying this, she raised her head up and is looking at me like, you're telling my story again. And she's been a part of this journey. I've never not worked for the church and not had this sweet dog who is a better minister than I am in so many ways. But when I first moved to the East Coast, I was scared to death. I had lived in the Kansas City area since I graduated college and had built all of my friendships and my loved ones were there. And then I'm being asked to go to the East Coast. And, you know, as a Midwest boy and a San Antonio boy, moving to the New York City area was a big challenge, a big step. And I had faith, you know, and I had a group of evangelists that are my support group, and they all said, you ought to look into it, you know, and I said, well, I just, you know, I just scared to death to do that, and they said, well, they're lovely people, so you ought to pray about it and do it and think about it, and so I did. I took the job, but I heard all along how these people on the East Coast are going to eat you up because you are a Midwest boy. And those people on the East Coast, they got no time for slow talking Midwest boys. And I wouldn't accuse me of being slow talker, but I was sufficiently scared when I got to the East Coast and I had moved for the first time. And Ellie and I moved up there, I would say in faith, because I couldn't envision what was going to happen. And I'm leaving everybody that loves me for a new strange place that I feel called to go to. I'd spent a lot of time in prayer, but it didn't ease some of those worries, those concerns about moving to a new strange land with different type people. And I remember after we got there, Ellie and I would walk every evening up to a high point that looked down over the river, the Delaware River, where Washington crossed the Delaware. We lived right there in a beautiful spot. And Ellie and I would walk up to the high point so we could see sunsets. And even though she's still got handicapped, she never could walk right. She's got a fused leg. She would still run that graveyard chasing deer. She could run like the wind, but she has trouble walking. And so every night when we would go up there, I would kind of do my prayers and watch the sunset. It was just beautiful. But I remember being scared to death, just the process of moving and meeting all these new people. And then what everybody had told me, that they were going to eat me alive. And my prayer this one night was this, and Ellie and I got to the graveyard right at sunset. And I'm like, you know, God, because I was feeling nervous. You know, God, if I fail up here, it's because I'm going to get lonely. And I was already kind of feeling lonely, I guess. And this one particular night, Ellie did not take off running the graveyard. She just sat right on the one road that splits the two sides of the graveyard and just turned around and looked at me. And she sat there, and I couldn't go forward. I was stopped right in the middle of the road, and I still thought that is a coincidence. And I'm like, okay, God, I know you sent Ellie to me. I know you do that. And you've done it all my life. You've always surrounded me with people and animals that love me. But if I get lonely here, this is the second time repeating this. If I get lonely here, I will go home. It won't be my fault. It'll be your fault because you asked me to come here and I'm going to get lonely. Do you ever play with God like that, Robin? I don't recommend you doing it when it's a cloudy day. But while I was standing there, it's just a really powerful experience to me. And God really knows us so well. Each and every one of us knows us so well that God uses our influences, our experiences to kind of work with us and to love on us. And Ellie was sitting there staring at me, and I'm like, I know you gave me Ellie. I realize that. And Robin, without taking another step, in fact, if I had taken a step, I wouldn't have seen this. On the back of a headstone to my left was the name Parker, and that was the dog I had right before Ellie and for a year at the same time. And on the right, on the other side of the road, on the back side, the family name was Casey, and that was the dog I had before Parker that I'd also rescued. And I remember just weeping and God just going, you know, I know you were kidding, Keith, but I'm not kidding. I haven't left you alone. Why do you do this? You know, and I never felt lonely after that. It was a challenge to go and move to a new location and start all over, but I never felt lonely after that. And the people there were wonderful. They get a bad rap, but they were wonderful. And we did some really good things on the East Coast of the United States there. And I got to work in a good place and a good environment, helping congregations find their own voice in their neighborhood. So
what came next after that? Because you had a big call come along and a big move, and I'm not sure which came first.
Well, it kind of came together. So I was on the East Coast for maybe 4 years, and things were going really good, really well. And I got a request from one of the apostles to get on a conference call. And I was doing this video project called We Share that I had spent a lot of time in video and taping people and wrote a script and just saying, giving people permission to invite them into your fellowship, you know. So I thought he was going to try to stop that project. And so I said, well, I'm already well into it. Because he used that as the reason to call me. And so when I got on the call, Dave Shaw, who was the president of the church at the time, and Bob Kaiser, Lynn Young, and Richard James, both apostles and a senior president of 70. And I knew I was in trouble then, by the way. So they said that I had received a call to be president of 70 and wanted me to seriously consider that. And they spent a lot of time. And I was in shock because I didn't see this one coming. I mean, I was enjoying doing what I was doing on the East Coast and helping people in congregations becoming invitational again. You know, we kind of lost that art sometimes. So my first instinct was, no, I'm not, I don't want to do that. I mean, I have invested now in what you've asked me to come here, and I've been here for 4 years and I'm really hitting my stride. I don't want to do that. So after the call, I didn't say yes or no. And after the call, I went into my bedroom and Ellie was laying on the bed, and I just remember, and they wanted me to move to Europe on top of that, and to be the president of the quorum that was for Eurasia and Western Europe and the British Isles. And I was scared to death again because, God, why? I just got things rolling here, and why would you ask me to start all over in a strange new land? And so I remember kneeling at my bed, what I've done every time when the church has asked me to do something different. And Ellie's head, face was right there with me. And I went to bed and I just said, you know, Ellie, I'll find a way if this is what we're called to do. And I still was, I think, leaning against it kind of because I just couldn't see the vision yet. But I said, and don't worry, Ellie, wherever I go, you go. And I had this wonderful experience that in this dream, I was sitting in a room with church leaders that had no faces. You know, dreams don't make a whole lot of sense anyway sometimes. But I had this dream that I would say it was the president of the church. I know who it was in the dream, but said, you know, we're going to ask you to do more, to sacrifice more, to be trusting in us and more. And when I woke up, I knew that I was called to do that. So I moved to London, and it took me 7 months to get my dog over, but I did what I promised her. And I got her over, and I'm not kidding, Robin, when I say she's a much better minister than I am, because she just worms her way right into people's heart, you know, with a limp and a pretty face, and she just worms her way right into people's hearts. And I could sit for hours and tell you about the wonderful things she's done as a minister, but I don't think you want to hear that. But I moved to London, and part of my responsibility was helping establish the church in new areas. One of the first calls I got was from a seeker in Spain. We don't have a church presence in the Kingdom of Spain. Didn't at that time. And he wanted to be baptized. And he was what we call post-Mormon and was wanting to find a fellowship. And so he was the most persistent seeker I've ever met in my life. Right? He did take no for an answer when I said, well, Miguel, I can't just come to Spain to baptize one person. Our church is traditionally poor in a wonderful way, but I can't just hop on a plane and go to Spain and baptize you. I think in the third or fourth conversation I had with him, he said, well, I'll just call Steve Veazey and ask him if you could come. And Steve became the president of the church. And I said, well, don't do that. I don't need to get in trouble. But the long and the short of it is I ended up going to Spain, didn't baptize him right away, but influential in helping start the church in Spain, in the Kingdom of Spain. And really proud of that because I spent hours and hours walking the neighborhoods in Madrid with my dog, Ellie, sometimes, and meeting people and starting a congregation in Madrid. And there's a wonderful story there that I could share later. But to this day, they've got a wonderful presence in Madrid, in Barcelona, and in down in Rota, Spain. So I feel really good about the time that I spent in the Kingdom of Spain, not speaking the language. Maybe I didn't even ask them to join the church. I asked them to get, you know, to give me their coat. Who knows what I said because my Spanish was terrible, but they still have a wonderful congregation or wonderful congregations going on in now those locations. So I've been really blessed over the years to be involved in things like that.
So at World Conference 2010, you were set apart to serve as a president on the Council of Presidents of 70, and your first quorum that you led was the Eurasia field.
Yep, yep.
And then you were there for a while, and then
4 years.
Yeah, then you moved back. So tell us what happened when you moved back to the U.S.
I was asked to move back to, and was really fortunate that Scott Murphy, who's also president of the church and field director of field ministries, gave me the opportunity to come back to Independence for a couple of years. And I switched fields with another president of 70 who went to Europe to kind of follow up on a lot of the things that we had started there and also see his own vision. And then I got to go back to Independence, reconnect with my great congregation there at Village Heights and kind of re-energize, I guess. You know, when you move, it's difficult anyway, but when you move overseas, it's even harder. And so, you know, after 4 years there, I was allowed to kind of come back here and re-energize and kind of get back involved in the USA. So I was the president of the Fourth Quorum, which was South Central State, South Central USA, and Southeast USA, which is essentially the bottom right-hand quadrant of the United States, and was working with seekers in that large area, geographical area for the church, and enjoyed, I think it was 3 years there. I'm trying to recall off the top of my head, but at least 3 years there, almost 3 years there in Independence, and did that. And got to reconnect with all my friends after 4 years of living overseas. And I enjoyed my time immensely. The English people are amazing. The Welsh people are amazing. But it was really interesting to go from different countries and see how very different people are. From the Netherlands to Spain to France, they're just different types of people. And I was really fortunate. Growing up again in San Antonio, I had a mix of cultures, so I always felt comfortable in Russia or Ukraine or in any of the countries I had visited and spent time in. I was always comfortable with people that were different in spite of the language difficulties that we have sometimes, but I'm really blessed. So I did get to come back to Independence and kind of re-energize, reconnect, and I was there for a few years.
And then last year, something wild happened, and you were asked to turn your world upside down once again. So tell us about that and the process of saying yes to your current role and assignment.
It's funny, when you said that, I thought you were going to say you were asked to turn in your priesthood card. I don't know why. One of the things I recognized early on with the very first seeker I had in Europe being post-Mormon, I started seeing, like so many of us in the community of Christ, including you, Robin, and so many wonderful people that came before us, Dale Luffman, that was an apostle who saw that there were a lot of people post-Mormon that were trying to find a fellowship in community of Christ. And some of us who spent a lot of time in prayer about the invitational ministries of community of Christ can say that we saw a vision, or we saw a new thing happening. We kind of had caught a whiff of what God was doing. And so at one point in my field, in the quorum that I was serving in the Southeast United States, started seeing a lot of people that are coming from the Mormon background continue their discipleship in community of Christ. So a few of us, yourself included, recognized that was, I think, a way of God giving us a glimpse of a vision for community of Christ. And we have been in the process of doing that for decades of working our theology to be a sound theology and going through some of the struggles that we see people going through in their own lives. We have done as an institution as well. And I would say changing our name to Community of Christ and Women in the Priesthood now put us on the precipice of seeing some amazing things happen, God getting us ready for a new group of people. So the first presidency asked me if I would move to Arizona to continue what we're seeing a lot in the Inland West and to continue to work with seekers, something that I had felt a passion for post-Mormon seekers, that I had felt a passion for several years now, having gotten the bug, I guess, by baptizing that one young man in Spain that was post-Mormon. And so we recognize there are a lot of people wanting to join our fellowship, God's fellowship that we are also involved in. And the reason I say it like that, Robin, is that I like to say that we are just custodians at our church. This church is not ours, and sometimes we take ownership of it so much that we start thinking of it as ours instead of maybe as God's. And I like to think of it more like I'm a custodian, that God's asking me to keep the doors open, keep the heat on, keep it warm, keep it clean, because I'm going to be inviting more people in, Keith. And so it keeps me from taking a detrimental ownership of the church, to where I'm cliquish, or we're cliquish. And so I really want this to be a church that God can invite anyone to, and we respond to who God is inviting and nudging this way. So I was asked to move to Arizona to because we have recognized that in this area there is a strong post-Mormon community that are interested in Community of Christ. So they asked me if I would maintain my quorum on the East Coast, Southeast Coast, but come here under special assignment to begin to see what God's up to and how we kind of can respond in that way. And that's been a wonderful experience. So many people that we come in contact with have been damaged because of theology and because of the actions of other people. And it's even more hurtful, I think, that they have been damaged by people that are of faith, or Christian faith. And so the stories that we hear daily, weekly, are very difficult because they have been excluded or excommunicated or have been asked to leave. And they're incredible people, wonderful people. And so our initiative is that we build a relationship with them, and then we connect them to a congregation if that's appropriate. Sometimes they are so hurt from what they've left that we try to discern where they are, and if they want fellowship but they're not ready to go to congregation, then we do it in what we call third place ministry in our home, in my home. I've had so many parties or pool parties or services here at my own house because they're just timid about finding a congregation and being rejected again. So getting to know them on a personal basis and what's right for them, and if possible, trying to connect them if they want this, and trying to connect them to a congregation. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Yes.
Are you getting tired of listening to me out there, America?
Not at all. We're eating it up, Keith. So it sounds to me as you continued in your ministry of invitation and witness and hospitality that in Arizona, you're really exploring, as you say, a third place ministry, which sounds like reflecting this experience of love that you experienced as a young child in your home congregation and have continued to experience in the life of the church in many ways throughout your life. And now as you endeavor to walk alongside seekers and people who are searching for a place to be safe and to feel loved, that you're reflecting that love wherever you are and have found ways to create that safe space that is overflowing with the presence of God, but not necessarily in the traditional context of the wall of a church. So tell us a little bit about some of the ways that you have walked with seekers, because you drive around in Arizona, different places, and you meet people in different places, including opening your home in ways that are so hospitable and warm and welcome to people of all ages and families with kids.
Lots of kids, yeah.
Lots of kids.
I mean, just like us, they're not monolithic, but what we're seeing, people that are trying to find a fellowship in Community of Christ, if you could say that there are certain characteristics that fit them, are very well-educated young adults with lots of kids and are so incredibly gifted in so many ways. For some of the women that I'm working with that have come from the Mormon faith, of course, they are incredible ministers in their own rights, just not having the right to priesthood. So one of my jobs is to empower people to say, you know, you're an amazing person with some incredible gifts. So at one point, it would be wonderful for me to see and for us to see that people that have found the fellowship stop becoming seekers in a way and become disciples. So that they then turn and start inviting as well because of what, and they're saying essentially, come and see what I found, because this is what we've been looking for. The theology of Community Christ is incredibly sound. I went on to get my master's degree in theology in religion, And I have just fallen in love with the theology of Community Christ. And so what we're seeing is some of the changes that Community Christ has gone through over the last few decades have gotten us ready for this time, so that people who've come from a different faith tradition, that they are incredibly gifted, but not have been allowed to share that giftedness because of either their sex or their views. If they're highly inquisitive, it's not always encouraged in that faith. And so we're seeing some really amazing people that are just looking to find what I had found in that little congregation in San Antonio, Delcrest, all those years ago, that will help raise their children, that will help encourage good theology and a healthy relationship with God and the pericopes that come along with the Christian faith. And so I've been really encouraged since I got here in April to see the number of people that we have connected with in wonderful ways that are just about the very basic. First of all, I recognize your worth. It doesn't come from me. I can recognize your worth, but that comes directly from God. And you don't need someone to mediate that. There's no in-between person here. God shares that wonderful concept with people. And so I just reinforce that your worth, it comes from God, and no person takes it away from you. And then how do we walk together? We become friends. We become loved ones. It isn't about joining the church. There's the Mormons have a way of really being strong about proselytizing. And we walk a fine line of saying we don't proselytize, but we want you to know there is a place where you can serve as incredible members and also as priesthood to help others in their lives. And so you build those relationships where you can recognize these incredible gifts that are unique to them, and then you accentuate those. You say, look who you are. You are an amazing person. And then you try to either fit them into a congregation that works for them, or you continue to walk with them and on a personal journey. And it's painful, Robin. I think you know this as well. It's painful when you get to know people who have been so pained by a faith tradition. It breaks my heart in a number of ways that people who should find love and unconditional love in our churches and in our faith traditions somehow get judged and marginalized. And it's just not right to me. And that goes back to my mother, who said all the way back, every person is important. Nobody is very important, which means that somebody is less important. It's a painful journey, especially for them, but for me as well, because I'm allowed into those dark places in their lives where they have been so damaged, and I'm called to walk with them. It doesn't ever mean it's conditional on you joining Community Christ. It means it's unconditional love that I'm just reflecting that God has always shown for me, even when I was a little demon in church. God never stopped loving me, and so that's my passion, is just sharing, helping restore the worth that the people have tried to take away, and then helping restore a fellowship that they deserve, and that we deserve their fellowship as well.
Yeah, I've watched you in ministry for many years, Keith, and I've learned a lot from you in watching.
A lot of what not to do?
No, I've learned a lot of really wonderful things, and I have seen how you create safe space for people. You meet them where they are with no strings attached.
Yeah.
And you are a faithful reflection of God's love. And that brings, that opens space for healing and wholeness and transformation. So it's such a delight to hear you talk about your ministry in Arizona, where you meet people over table fellowship in restaurants or in their homes or in your home. You do fun things together, like going to plays. You invite people to go to a reunion at our family camps and invite them to just bask in the glory of God's nature and be who they are.
Yeah, it's been really exciting to see that happen in their lives. And I was inviting people to come to reunion, and I finally had to quit because nobody said no. 100% of them said they would come, and I was so worried about having so many seekers at a small reunion, but our church people were just lovely to them, inviting them straight into their life. And, you know, they didn't ask my permission. They just started hanging out with them on their own, you know? So it's kind of wonderful to sit back and go, hey, you know, those are my friends. And they're like, no, those are my friends. So, we are so blessed by each other. It's not just a one-way street. You know, they bless us and we bless them. And it's wonderful to see. It's been an, you know, I don't want to diminish what I've done in other places, but this has been one of the most exciting parts of my journey so far, because I can see people finding, I can see those little girls growing up and becoming nurses and going to Graceland, those little Sakiles.
Yeah.
I can see wonderful support and love. And I'm just amazed at what's happening. It's been wonderful.
So you've had tons of experiences in many diverse contexts and cultures, places of the world, mm-hmm. where God has invited you into these missional relationships and journeys. So as you look back on that, gosh, it's been a couple decades now since you were first a priest, maybe longer. I don't want to tell your age.
85. It's been longer than a couple of decades.
So as you look at that, do you see some key dimensions of mission that remain constants across all of these diverse experiences of mission?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think you probably have heard undertones of that. And what I'm saying is that mission is totally relational. So many times a congregation that wants to, or a mission center that wants to be invitational, develop a program and say, here's what we're going to do. And we'll invite the neighborhood into that program. And I think that's exactly backwards. What we need to do is be on the ground, recognizing the needs of our communities or whatever we're planning on doing. First of all, doing it prayerfully in a disciplined way, but then seeing what the needs are and then develop the program. So do it the other way around. Find out what people need in their lives. Just like at Hawthorne, we walked the neighborhood, we got to know those people, and we responded to their needs by building the program that support that. So everything is contextual, of course, for where you're living and what you're doing, and there's different types, and it's also being flexible, being constantly in prayer, going, okay, God, you've invited me into this journey, it's your journey and that I'm coming along with. How do we co-create what you're needing to happen in this neighborhood or in this person's life? How do we do this? So it's remaining flexible as well. So the very basic is you're in a relationship with people, period, right? And then responding to their needs, whether it be in a community to find theology or a religion, or if it's meeting their needs literally with social programs or things like that, that then invite them in. The cross-pollination, I guess, is a great way of saying it, that you are helping develop a social program that also then feeds into the theology or vice versa. But it's always relational. You've got to get to know people and you've got to spend time in their lives. It's hard work. It isn't done overnight. And there are disappointments along the way and how you meet those disappointments, but also how do you keep inviting people into the paradigm of the mission? How you keep inviting people in to be guides on the journey, but you're also inviting people to be participants in the journey. So it's just staying aware of the circumstances and doing everything, of course, out of love, not judgmental, not the heavy-handedness that we used to see out of Christianity, but instead based out of love. And how do we? And it's not building numbers either. It's not about building a church. It's about inviting people into relationship with God, and the church happens to be the vehicle. And the vehicle has to be running and in tune and ready to go. But you use the vehicle then to get people in a personal relationship with God. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, I've heard you say some really important things. I've heard you talk about just the absolute critical nature of authentic relationship. You've talked about prayer, of knowing the people so you can identify their needs and then respond to those needs. I love the way you take note that so often we kind of develop the program before we even know the people that we're going to target it at. So,
and then we wonder why nobody comes to the program. Why is nobody loving what we're doing? And the sad thing is sometimes then people give up, right?
Yeah.
No, we tried that before. We tried inviting people and they didn't come. We even developed this wonderful program. You know, we maybe developed a senior program for a bunch of kids and we wondered why they didn't come, you know?
Yeah.
I sound sarcastic. What I'm trying to say is don't give up. Keep listening for the vision that God is putting on your heart in your congregation or wherever you're serving, but don't give up because the relationships are what it's about.
Yeah, that hanging in there with God. I love the way you talk about being open to being flexible because it is a journey with God and things can change along the way or our understanding can change along the way.
Yeah, we see through glasses dimly lit or something like that. Some wise man or wise person said, right? So being flexible means that we don't have the full picture sometimes of what God's up to, and it's not because God doesn't want to share it with us. It's maybe we're not listening fully and intently enough to catch the whole vision. So being flexible and not getting frustrated and not quitting because people are worth not quitting on.
Mm-hmm. So you've kind of alluded to this today as we've gone along with you on your journey of discipleship, ministry, and mission, that the paradigm of mission has changed. We find ourselves in a new place. How would you describe that current paradigm of mission?
Yeah, I've been fortunate, I think, sometime through my experiences to see that things have changed, and some of the frustration and pain, and understandably so, that we hear from longtime church members that nobody's coming to church anymore. I remember when this building used to be filled, and it's kind of it's seeing a reality on the ground, but not understanding why that's happening because we are not keeping up with the changes that are happening in people's lives. And sometimes instead of saying, okay, we see that something's happening and it isn't about numbers, but we're still going to be engaged in people's lives, then we change pretty quickly. If we're hoping to take the church backwards to a place where it was full, I think that's the wrong approach. I've been to some really small congregations that have been incredible participants in the neighborhood, in their lives, and are making a difference. And I've been in larger congregations where it just seems like the joy of the gospel has gone from them because they're seeing a decline. They're sort of seeing the glass half empty as opposed to saying, you know, I don't care. God's the one doing the work and inviting us in. If there was one person coming with me to church, I'm great with that. You know, my nephew, when he was going to college in Rolla at the University of Missouri, Rolla, used to go to church on Sundays at that congregation with one other man. And Brad was so religious about going to church, but he still, and to this day, he goes to Thunderbird West here in the Arizona area. But he spent some quality time with a wonderful, wise, older man who they met every Sunday. If it was just them, they just met. I mean, that's what it's about too, right? The relationship, not just a large congregation where you're a number, nobody knows you're coming or going. So the paradigm change, it's contextual for where you live and what you're seeing, but I can't ever get to the place where I have a defeatist attitude about it, because if I have one person come to church, and I've had this happen over and over, the story I told you about Sakile, if I did nothing else but that little girl changed her life around because of our church, right?
Mm-hmm.
How incredible is that? Instead of me going, well, too bad there's not more Sakile's around, you know, and pretty soon you become so cynical about life-changing things that happen in people's lives that you can lose the vision of it. So you've got to – the gospel is the good news. That's what it translates into. So how are we inviting people into good news, into great things, into hopeful situations and loving places instead of looking backwards going, well, it's not what it used to be. And, you know, I would say probably 100 years from now, Robin, you'll still be alive because you're young. but I won't be. But people will probably be going, some people will probably be going, well, it's just not what it used to. I remember, you know, they might be saying, I remember when I came here and we had 50 people. Now we got 300 people. It's just not the same anymore. So I don't worry about numbers. I worry about people's lives, walking with them on their journey. And I leave the number stuff up to God, and, you know, I'm okay with where it is. But the paradigm, it's important to grasp that things are changing, and there's nothing you could do to stop the change. It's how do we adapt to the change? Yeah. So we're seeing in the, like here in the Seekers and this area, Robin, we're seeing young adults with lots of kids. That's a new paradigm for some congregations. So how do we change? Well, first of all, we meet the reality on the ground. We better be expecting a lot of kids, and we better be expecting to share the leadership with people that are completely different than us. And it's a wonderful thing. It's not a, oh no, kind of thing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I am excited. I mean, I'm that kind of guy anyway, but because the church changes people's lives, God changes people's lives through this church. And I am a walking witness of that. You know, I used to say, you know, I used to be a dirt bag. God made me a gift bag, and people objected to that. But I say it in all sense of humility that God has just changed my life in incredible ways through this church. And I love this church, and this church has the capacity and the giftedness to change our communities in incredible ways. And we see it. So,
well, I love the way in a changing world you speak about the church is called to be flexible, and if there's one thing that we know how to do in Community of Christ, because we've been called to do it many times in our history, is to be flexible and to be God's witness, regardless of where we are or where we're meeting people. So it's exciting to hear how excited you are about mission and how you see mission emerging now and into the future. You've already forecast 100 years ahead. So this is good. So well,
go ahead.
What tips do you have for people who want to engage in mission in the places they live and serve?
You're talking about like congregations or?
Well, it could be a congregation, or it might be a couple young adults that they go to church once a month, but they feel it and they feel that same excitement you do, and they want to be relevant.
Well, I would say, first of all, thank God they feel excited, because when you turn the corner from being a seeker to becoming a disciple, you're saying, okay, God, you've changed my life. How do I help do that in somebody else's life, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're saying, and it's a wonderful, when I see this happening in people's lives, I mean, it could just bring you to tears, because you see a life completely transformed and re-energized. You see somebody who has been denigrated because their sexual orientation or their race or their, you know, whether they're male or female, and you see that worth restored and they become empowered, and then you're going, wow, that transformation was incredible. So I've had this in my own life, and I've seen it in others' lives. And so I'm excited when somebody says, that's happened to me. How do I now do that on my own, God? So yeah, being flexible, being prayerful, right? So being and being engaged in their lives. So you will see sometimes people at their worst, and you don't quit on them, because God never once quit on me, right? And so you don't quit on them, even if you get disappointed. In fact, we learn sometimes more out of the adversity in life than we do out of the abundance. So when you are engaged in people's lives and they let you down for whatever reason, you unconditionally love them and forgive them immediately, and you keep walking with them. You know, sometimes some of the people I walk with, when they think they've disappointed me and they find out I haven't left them, that's a joy in itself, right? Because they're like, Keith, you know, you've always stuck with me. And, you know, why is that? And I'm like, because I know who you are and I know your heart. And, you know, and you don't quit on people just because they disappoint you, or else I wouldn't have anybody in my life. And so I would say that, you know, people that are wanting to do that, be flexible and recognizing the vision of what God's doing, being prayerful about being engaged in it, and then just do it. You know, just step out. You're going to make mistakes, but first of all, when people know you're doing something out of love and you make mistakes, they show incredible grace. But But if we are constantly praying about it and discerning it and we never act on it, we are missing the key component, because Jesus always prayed. He always discerned. And then you know what he did? He went out and did it. When he said, God, I'm catching this vision. And then he told people, this is what God's calling me to do. And guess what? I'm going to do it. And then in, next few pages in our scriptures, he does it. So don't be afraid to step out and do what you feel God is calling you to do. Because if you don't act on it, then the dream can die with you, or the vision dies with you. I don't think God's small enough that if we don't fulfill our obligation to help people find a loving community, that God's not going to compensate for that. But if we can do it, then maybe they don't suffer as long. Maybe they find a community that loves them immediately, and God doesn't have to try to work somebody else into the equation later. That's what keeps me up at night, that I miss an opportunity to invite somebody into this incredible fellowship that I've had in my life. You know, what if Dr. Millenizer hadn't invited me all those years ago to be a part of his life in that community? Where would I be today? That scares me. You know, I know I'm in great shape, but what it scares me that I might miss an opportunity to help somebody find a wonderful relationship with God. That really keeps me awake and keeps me going. And, you know, I don't even remember what you asked. It's been so long. I've been talking so much.
I love the way you say invite people to be part of your life. I mean, that just, we can do that no matter who we are, or where we are.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing. So Keith, is there anything that you wanted to talk about or share about that I haven't asked you about today?
Ooh, that's a loaded question. How much more time do we have? No, I want to share, first of all, thank you for inviting me to do this podcast. I really love people. God has instilled in me this wonderful little Energizer bunny inside my heart. I really love people. And one of the things that I could do that's long lasting in people's lives is helping them connect with a God that unconditionally loves them. Unconditionally. Not keeping a list of all the things you've done wrong in your life. And then, oh my God, if you don't compensate for all those wrong things by doing some right things and evening out the balance, the ledger, that's not how God works. You could do a whole lot of bad things. Trust me when I say this, because I don't think I know I didn't like who I used to be, but this part of my journey, but it's also given me a heart for people who have made some of the same mistakes I've made in my life. And God never left me, never once. I would just say I love this church because it's transformed my life and the lives of many other people. And I want to share that with whoever would love to find a fellowship. So thanks for having me come in and bloviate for so long.
Well, thank you, Keith. And on behalf of all the people that love you and the many lives that you have touched, I want to say thank you for saying yes to God's invitation to this journey of mission.
Thank you very much.
You are the real deal, Keith. And you have touched my life in countless ways. And I know that I always run into people in the field that say, I know Keith. Oh my gosh, how's he doing? I just love him. And then they tell me the story of how you've touched their life. And I remember when we were, so I was one of the seven that was set apart as a president of 70 at World Conference 2010. So Keith was one of those seven. It was such a privilege to serve with you, Keith, in the council. Yeah. I remember at that World Conference afterwards, people were coming up and congratulating us, and you were swarmed by people. And you had shells from the Tahitians that went up almost to your eyeballs because they were giving you the shell necklaces and kissing you on each.
I've been lucky. I went to Tahiti and fell in love with the Tahitian people there. And so my ordination was their ordination, is the way they saw it. So
yes, that was a beautiful thing to see. It was an evidence of how beloved you are in the life of this.
Thank you. Well, it's not a one-way street. I definitely get this wonderful way God works is you think you're providing ministry, you end up getting more ministry yourself. I mean,
it's not the truth, but a joy.
It's the truth, yeah.
Well, thank you again, Keith, for being with us today.
Thank you, and thanks for all the patient people out there listening.
Yes, for those of you listening to this podcast, thank you for joining us as we explore mission and faith and spirituality and how God is making a difference in our world. This is Robin Linkhart, and you are listening to What's Brewing on Project Zion Podcast. Go out and make the world a better place.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use, and while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.